And incest are most concerned about it in the, quote, initial months. Could you respond to that?
Well, I think that is just incredibly cruel. To say that, you know, to put himself in the place of a rape survivor and try and make assumptions about what that person is going through is just... it just floors me. And it's completely opposite of what we know about trauma and PTSD and what survivors go through. You know, it assumes that you go through this traumatic experience and you're just on top of your game, taking care of things, just getting it done. You know, that's not the way it works. You know, you have to process that trauma,
Heather,
and that can take months.
Yes. We have to break, and I want to thank you very much for being with us. Heather Busby, Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Texas. Of course, Governor Walker, Governor of Wisconsin, is believed to be planning a run for the presidency. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is hiring two full-time positions, a senior news producer and an engagement editor. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Phelps, Aaron Mate, Steve Martinez, Sam Alcock, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen, Dina Guster, Amy Littlefield, Anna Osbeck, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Noguera, our engineers. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prud, and Vesta Godarz. I'm Amy Goodman with Noreen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with our host, Joanne Hardesty. Today's guest is Jason Renault from Street Roots.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor for ALEC Expo's film screening and workshop on June 18th, 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. ALEC, the American Legislators Exchange Council, is a corporate-directed organization which writes model legislation for state legislatures around the nation that is beneficial to multinational corporations. Secretive corporate-directed and funded organizations like ALEC undermine the principles of citizens participating in democratic processes. ALEC Exposed explains how ALEC functions, who is involved, and how to fight back to promote democratic, non-corporate values. Again, that's ALEC Exposed, June 18th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Southwest 12th and Salmon in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Nepal Aid Concert, Saturday, June 20th at 7 p.m. at 4200 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. The event will feature live music by Manda and the Latin Sound Trio, poetry by Alex Dang, Nepali dance performances and lessons, and more. Again, that's the Nepal Aid Concert, Saturday, June 20th, 7 p.m. at 4200 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, jazz lovers. This is Mike. I wanted to tell you about my new podcast that just went live on KBOO website. It's called Unsung Heroes of Jazz, where every week we'll feature an artist who recorded between the 1940s and the 1960s, so-called golden era of jazz, but for whatever reason never really got the recognition they so richly deserved. We'll tell you a little bit about them, play some of their music. Some of them you will have heard of, some of them you won't, but in all cases they certainly deserve more recognition than they got. We think it's a different wrinkle, and we hope you'll enjoy it, and really hope you'll join us. Thank you.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Good morning, good morning. Welcome to Voices from the Edge. I am Joanne Hardesty, and it's my pleasure to be here with you today. I have in the studio with me Jason Renault. He is with the Mental Health Association of Portland, among other many hats that he wears. He's not actually with Street Roots, but he did write several articles with Street Roots, and we're going to talk about that and a whole host of other things today. Welcome to the studio, Jason.
Oh, thanks, Joanne.
It is such a pleasure to have you here, and you and I go way, way, way back. We go back to the DOJ investigation. We go back before that, go back to the Kendra James, and just so many events. I invited you here today because you've been doing a series of articles with Street Roots, and I wanted to get into conversations about those articles. So you want to start with the first one?
No, sure.
Okay.
Well, the first one was in the Scanner. And it was last year. And what we did was we were interested in the question of how many people are harmed and how many people are killed by police officers. Mm. And we decided that the FBI had issued a number of 400 persons killed per year. And that comes from their survey of each state's coroner and their listing of lethal in interventions, and that's death by police or executions, and they listed that number at 400. So that's not an accurate number, and we thought it's very small. So what we did was we worked with Wikipedia of all places, and people literally all over the world, 40 or 50 different Wikipedia contributors, to create a list of everyone killed in the United States by law enforcement officers in October of 2014. And we wrote about this in the Scanner. I think it was reprinted in the Portland Mercury and a few other papers around the country. And the results were rather remarkable. We found that about 105 people were killed in that month, in a variety of ways that were very unusual and very different than any one community when you see the spectrum of deaths in the United States. We included police officer suicides, and unfortunately there were 5 of those that month. We included homicides by police officers in off-duty, and there were 4 of those, including 2 husband and wife officers in Oklahoma who killed their daughter's boyfriend.
Wow.
So a variety of deaths, and each of them were very different, but there were some distinctive demographics that stepped through. And one is that the two predominant demographics, one is that persons of color were harmed at a much higher rate than the population of those communities. And second is that persons who were impaired, persons who had a mental illness, persons who were drunk or loaded were harmed at a remarkable rate, about 60, 65, 67% of the persons that we were able to find in the public record were impaired in one way or another.
Wow. And so that 400 number is across the country.
That's right. That's right.
And so what kind of a conclusion did you come to based on the data that you collected?
Well, the conclusions were that this is a really complicated survey to do and really complicated data to analyze. And what we really wanted was someone to come to it more aggressively and with better tools and look at it. And that was just printed, I think 3 days ago in the Guardian newspaper, an English newspaper, has done a remarkable survey, and their numbers match ours, and they're looking at that a year total is going to be about 1,200 persons killed by police in the United States. And this is a considerably larger number than the FBI, and really has excited a lot of advocates in the thinking that we really need to address this more aggressively.
Well, I think there's good news in that discovery, because certainly more people are paying attention now to what's happening with police and police violence in local communities. Been protests all over the country, and some places civil disobedience broke out, and so there seems to be a desire to understand what the problem is and then try to fix it.
Right. I think that there's a very, I think positive is the right word. We really approach these problems with an optimistic perspective that we can, as citizen advocates, help the police bureau in keeping our community safe.
Mm-hmm. And so that was the first article, and the second article.
The second article was published in the Street Roots newspaper back in May, and it talks about a list that we've been keeping for many years, and this list was inspired by other organizations such as Portland Cop Watch. And it's a list of all the persons harmed by police officers. It's persons who are harmed by the police officers in the 9 surrounding bureaus to Portland. So that's Hillsborough and Gresham and Little Fairview and of course, the Portland Police Bureau, and then also the county sheriff's department. So we have a list of 300 persons who were beaten, who were shot at, people who were tased, people who were harmed by police officers in on duty. And this list is, we have newspaper articles to go with each person on this list, and the list is far larger than anyone had thought in the past. The distinctive demographics are the same. Persons of color are injured more often than the local statistics, local population, and persons who are impaired, who are in a mental health crisis. About 64% of those persons, 110 out of the 171 persons killed were persons who were in a mental health crisis. And this is a large number we didn't know before.
Right. And so, the community is the one that is forced to gather this information, because you can't go to the police bureaus and say, how many people have you injured? Because as you state in your article, you state 6 reasons why police may not be held accountable, right? And the first one is it didn't happen, right? And basically, if you weren't there, it didn't happen.
Well, that's right. There's the third article is what asked the question that so many of us asked after Michael Brown's verdict, the Ferguson verdict came in, that the district attorney chose not to indict the officer. I think his name is Darren Wilson.
Right.
And we came to this and said, well, why is it that district attorneys don't indict? And we called all the Oregon, the 36 or so Oregon district attorneys, and emailed them and asked them, have you done this? Have you ever indicted a police officer?
Right.
And have you ever convicted a police officer? And we got answers back from quite a few of them, about 26 out of the 36. And 72% of the officers said they had, or excuse me, the district attorney said they had not
ever
charged a police officer. Now, Portland, Multnomah County, has charged police officers twice, the first in 1969, and the last one was in 2013. So that's 2 officers in 40-some years, and the last officer who was indicted was Officer Dane Reister, who injured a person named William Monroe, a man with bipolar disorder, and unfortunately, Mr. Reister, who was left dangling with charges against him, chose to commit suicide last week.
Right. I did hear about that, which was tragic, which all of it was tragic, really. This article, it starts, I mean, I think that's, you're right, one of the compelling questions that people want to know is, well, of course police are going to be held accountable if there's, and especially with the cameras, right? Because right now, Portland police can't wait for the legislature to vote on House Bill 2157, which is the body camera bill. And I think a lot of the public thinks, you know, body cameras are the perfect solution, right? Because if you put a body camera on a cop, it's going to record everything.
Well, no. This is a foolish process that's going to harm our civil liberties and our privacy. And you need to be concerned that the police bureaus in cities, which pay a lot of money in litigation costs, are running to this solution, which doesn't really...
I would say they're not paying the money. We are paying the money. That's the only correction I would make. But yes, yeah, so House Bill 2157 voted out of the House with a 51-9 vote. 9 Republicans voted against it. It voted out of the Senate committee last week. I expect it to come to the Senate floor sometime very soon. House Bill 2157 is the body camera bill that basically gives police total control of when to turn it on, has the ownership of the film by the policing agency themselves, would allow police to review the video before they wrote their written report, so they could make sure that the written report matched what was seen in the video. In addition, there's no public access to the video. The video, unless you're in it, and if you're in it, you could do a public records request, but the faces will be blurred. So
right, if you're not the only one in the picture.
Yes, if you're not the only one in the picture, then you have a problem. And there's a clause that says only for law enforcement purposes. So think about a tool that is being sold to the public as an accountability tool, actually being used to actually gather data and keep it secret, and then, which is not different than what we currently have.
Well, there is a very valuable reason for body cameras that has nothing to do with use of force, which would be for training purposes.
Yes.
And what our understanding is from Joanne, you held a forum in East County with the City Club a couple weeks ago.
Right.
We learned from officers at that point that the body camera video would not be used by sergeants for just regular routine training purposes.
Yes.
Hey, officer, we saw you do this. We'd like you to do that.
Right.
That's a way that we can really improve officer performance. But
if the public doesn't have access to it, right? If you're going to use it just for a training tool, then you're saying is that could be a plausible reason.
That'd be very valuable.
But to spend $880,000 to buy them then hire 6 new analysts to analyze that data that the public never has access to, I just think it's criminal. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. We have a caller on the line. Hello, Paul. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning, Paul. Hey, stranger. How are you?
Oh, good, good. I got just a little bit of time this morning. I always appreciate your show, and I really appreciate your guest today. And I have 2 questions for Mr. Renault. I forget exactly how you said it a couple of minutes ago, but what would it take legislatively to hold these officers accountable? I mean, obviously it seems to me that something has to be changed in the code. And the second question is, and I hope the answer is yes, are you contemplating another run for city councilor or mayor? And I will take my answers off the air.
Thank you, Paul, for your questions. Very good ones. Have a good day.
Thanks, Paul. I'll answer the second one first. That's a bad job. No, that doesn't.
That needs good people.
Yeah, I can't take the pay cut.
You're not joking. Okay.
It's expensive in all kinds of ways.
Oh, definitely.
But the third article talks about how the key regulator for police use of force and undue force is the district attorney. There's about 30 different levels of police oversight in Portland. And if you go to the Street Roots site and you look for our article, it's called Cops Use of Force, Why So Few Charges. At the bottom of the article, you'll see this listing of 29 or 30 different levels of oversight. And these include things like the Portland City Council and the media and even individuals like Joanne Hardesty. It also includes the coroner's office and, say, police policy. But the key person, the key individual, the elected and funded individual to regulate undue force is the district attorney. If that district attorney is not a functioning regulator, if they are not using the law as written to indict officers, bring them to trial, and find out in a fair hearing if this person has committed a crime, then we don't have police oversight at any level.
Right. And I think, I actually think we have the illusion of police oversight, because if you look, it starts within the police bureau. So you have the independent investigative division that actually that basically does all police investigations. So they are the ones who investigate police. So you have police investigating themselves. Then we have the IPR, which is an independent, doesn't really review the police, but review police reports of police reviewing police misconduct, and then makes a determination based on that. You've got the Citizen Review Committee, which again is a process that's three steps removed from the actual ability to discipline an officer, because it's an appeal process that the public goes through, which normally ends up with finding in favor of the community member. And so, and because the IPR throws out 72% of the complaints they get in each year, houseless people and complaints of racial disparate treatment are the two biggest categories of people's whose complaints they don't even bother to review. And so when we hold this up, it's like we've got account, we have no accountability. And just like when PIAC existed, you remember PIAC?
Yeah, yeah.
When PIAC existed, there was no accountability built into the system, and it didn't collapse until all the members, the community members, just quit.
They all resigned.
They all resigned.
They felt that their advice was not being followed.
Right, and that they were set up for failure. Mm. And so they quit, right? And I hope that IPR will do that, because it's a useless operation that we're spending a lot of money on pretending somehow we have accountability.
Right, and as long as people are continuing to follow this pretense,
right,
we can't get to real accountability.
That's right, that's right. And one of the questions that Paul asked that I think is really important, which was, what is the legislative route?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the challenge with a legislative route is currently the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee have retired police officers pretty much controlling police legislation that comes through. And House Bill 2157 is a perfect example, because House Bill 2758 is where it started as a really decent police accountability bill. And with all the legislative compromises, working with the unions, the police unions and the Sheriff's Association and all those in Salem, they come up with this piece of nonsense that Democrats are going to, you know, we did police accountability. We fixed what was wrong with police, and we can't let people get away with these pretend solutions. And I think that's part of the challenge, because if you're sitting here, you read the headline in the Oregonian, oh, great, now we got body cam. We're going to have police accountability. No, we won't.
Well, our article asks that the state attorney general lead this conversation about how to encourage district attorneys to reduce their conflict of interest. And in cases where there is a fatality, we ask that the state attorney general influence those district attorneys to select an adjacent district attorney. They do this all the time with conflict of interest.
Yes, yes.
Where, say, the district attorney from Multnomah County asks the district attorney from, say, Tillamook County to
right.
come in and try this particular case.
There,
you have a person who is funded and is knowledgeable and skilled. You're not recreating the process with an independent investigator. That a special prosecutor, that sounds kind of farfalutin, but there is the process in place, and the attorney general can make that happen simply by making a phone call. We don't need to go and make a law about this, but
really?
She does need to make a phone call and say, no, you need to have someone else do this.
Well, it's interesting because you may remember Portland Cop Watch did an analysis of police shootings around the state mm-hmm. and sent it to the attorney general mm-hmm. because she's responsible for collecting that data. And what Dan found was that the data had been collected, but not actually sent to the attorney general. It was sent to the Oregon Health Department, and so collected as part of the official deaths in Oregon data, but totally disconnected from the accountability of what a police agency is doing around the state to cause these deaths or injuries. And I don't know that he's heard back from her, because he actually sent her a report that said, I think it was like 100 and... It was a little over 100 over a 10-year period of time. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, what are you doing with this data? What, you know, how are you collect? And she didn't even know it was part of her job.
Yeah, the police accountability is a bit of a hot potato for politicians to touch. It's really why advocates who are in the community are so vital here. And we really do need to get more people involved and engaged and knowledgeable with organizations like the Albina Ministerial Alliance to learn about these issues, to get themselves trained and to start attending. There's a lot of work to be done.
There's a lot of work to be done and a lot of meetings that are sucking up the air in the room. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Hello, David. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Oh, hey, morning. You know, I read this interesting book a little while ago, about how Poland had to create their own justice system while the Nazis occupied it. And this book is called The Story of a Secret State. Hmm. So the whole idea, when you look at the idea that organized crime has taken over the police department, or what's even worse, there was a famous thing called Operation Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O, where the Nazis, after World War II, put themselves into positions of power. And police departments are clearly a place of that. And so, you know, whether it's Klansmen or Nazis or military-industrial complex types, private prison profiteers, you know, these people are in charge. And when you see Ferguson, for example, where they structured the city so that they could milk the population out of parking tickets and jaywalking tickets and, you know, now they're coming up with even creepier ones where if you have a hole in your screen, you can actually get a ticket. And if you don't show up for that ticket, then they got a bench warrant waiting for you to go to a private prison.
Right.
So, you know, these people are profiteering from the justice system. Justice is supposed to be not an issue of cost effectiveness. Justice is justice. And the idea that these guys have milked every operation and now they're trying to privatize justice, you know, that's really the structure. So that's why I brought up that book. You know, it's this idea that during times of tyranny, this has come up tens of thousands of times in history.
Right.
And every, whether it's local communities or the bigger scale, you know, it's a funny thing, just as a one-sider, you know, in Watergate, they always talked about follow the money.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how, like in Ferguson and all these places, they're getting these tanks and big, you know, warships, so to speak.
Right.
So when you look at the dollar value, you start following the money about that.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are stealing it left and right. And people can get rid of these sheriffs real quick and these police chiefs and commanders and whatnot real quick by just following the money. Because we bought that stuff already in Iraq, and then some brokers and a number of brokers shifting it back and forth and storage fees and all this sort of stuff.
Right, and in fact, they give it to police departments for free, so...
Well, they claim they do, but there's transportation costs and security costs.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, these guys...
And you got to get it back, right.
Yeah, well, we can get... You know, if we're stuck, if America is stuck with a corrupt series of police departments and going back decades... You know, the idea that they're putting in their sons and their grandsons into positions of power.
Well, I think the problem is police departments were built originally as slave catchers, and then after that, they were built to protect property owners and their property. And policing hasn't changed much since those two.
As
far as priorities are concerned, the priorities are absolutely the same, right? And the expanded powers are about containment of certain people. So you have good community members and not good community members. And the police get to decide who they are and how they operate. And so I do agree with you that this, A, is not a new problem. And B, it's a problem that is left to the public to solve. No police agency is going to fix what's wrong with policing in America. It's going to take the public to fix it.
I agree, and that's why you got to have good auditors. Even during Election Day, when you elect your local treasurer or you elect your local auditor, like this. In fact, a story you might want to track, if I remember right, there's a local auditor, and I can't remember if she's in Pittsburgh or I think it's Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, and she has decided that she's going to do some real work, right? So she's going to audit the convention center and the police department, and I think the Port Commission and the mayor's office. She decides she's going to audit the mayor, and all of a sudden they shut her down. And I mean, the police department has gone to court a number of times to refuse to submit documents.
Thank you.
This woman's got some courage, and so...
That's what we need, more politicians with political courage. But Jason is really trying to get a word in edgewise, and between you and I, it's just not happening. Yes, Jason.
Joanne and I have spent thousands of hours working on police accountability issues in Portland, and it's not because we're cynical. It's because we are, at heart, optimistic and maybe a little impatient.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially optimistic, and we are that way because, I'm not going to speak for Joanne on this, because I think that the Portland Police Bureau versus maybe bureaus in, say, Ferguson, Missouri, are interested in listening, that they are, they have the ability to change, and they have improved significantly over the last, when we look back the last decade or so since James Chassis, there have been a lot of changes that are positive. Now, we're not satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
We're not finished, but we're not cynical.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see that corruption of the normal nature of the mm-hmm. people taking money home in a brown paper bag is happening here.
Right. No, I agree with that.
But it's even faster, though. Do you remember how, who was the congressman from, Top Gun congressman from San Diego? He was busted. One of the fattest plums he got was when somebody bought his house at three times estimated value.
We can always find the exception, but the rule here in Portland is that we don't think that that's happening here.
Well, no, I agree with Jason. I don't think that people are taking home bags of money, but I think the arrogant neglect Pacific Northwest nice prevents us from solving systemic problems. And so, no, I don't think that there's corruption, but political neglect is just as egregious as, I think, corruption. Because if you're elected to serve everybody, but you only serve the people who have money, that's a problem. Thank you for your call. Have a great day.
Just check out Gladio, Project Gladio. You'll see what I mean.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the call. Have a great day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I am talking to Jason Renault. He is with the Mental Health Association of Oregon, among many other hats. He's a police accountability activist. I want to make sure to publicize, because I talk about the IPR all the time, and people's eyes glaze over, especially the people who work for IPR, when I talk about how really useless they are. But your article quotes 338 complaints about police were filed with IPR, and this is from their 2013 report. And 331 of those 338 complaints were dismissed by IPR or send back to the police for resolution.
Yeah, that's an astounding number and really questions the usefulness of that bureau. Let me make a comment about it. I had a chance to talk with, I went and bought a copy of the Street Roots to see whether they actually printed the article.
Right.
And, I'm very happy to see that. And talked to the vendor for a few minutes, and I noticed that he had a broken hand, and I asked him about that. He said, the officers took me to jail, and they put me in double handcuffs, and then they kicked my legs out from underneath me, and I fell and broke my hand. I said, "Wow, did you think about going to the IPR?" And he looked at me like, "You don't know
what's
going on.
Are you out of your mind?" Right?
Yeah, yeah. Because I have enough problems. He says,
right,
without getting into that.
And I think that's what we've taught community members without enough money to hire a lawyer, right? What we've taught them is that you don't matter, right? And don't bother complaining because no one's going to listen and no one's going to do anything. And the fact that we can print on the public dime a report every single year that pretty much tells us the exact same thing from IPR, and we somehow call that success, is a horrible failure for our community. Police have impunity is number four on your list. We talked about the DAs. And police have impunity. Basically, what I believe is the police narrative is the one that normally survives unless somebody happens to have a community member happens to have a camera or video or phone or their witnesses.
Right. It has been the visual image that has accelerated these cases across the country. And even a good snapshot of the individual, the surviving individual, is increases the amount of attention by the media and by the community. So the first of these, of course, and what we really think about when we think about undue force is Rodney King.
Yes.
Back in 1991, younger folks may not remember, but Rodney King was an African-American man who was coming home a little intoxicated and met some police officers who beat the crap out of him. Well, unusual at that time, someone had a home video camera, stuck it out their window and videotaped the whole thing. This transformed the LA Police Department.
Yes, it did.
In James Chassie's case, it was a young waiter at a restaurant across from where James was being beaten who captured the aftermath with just his cell phone camera. Mm-hmm. And that really, we were able to leverage those pictures to get the community engaged and interested and knowledgeable about what happened to Chassie. And now with Freddie Gray, we see this again.
Yes. And I was going to say the same with Keaton Otis, right? If it wasn't for Christina, who, fearing her own life, was in her apartment filming the police shooting Keaton Otis, that whole scene. If the public looks at it, they see that he's yelling, "My hands up, my hands up, my hands up," just before they shoot him 26 times. What's interesting is the video that appears to be the most valuable is when either the police don't know they're being filmed, or B, a community member is filming it. That's the police, and even police cameras. We've seen both the cameras that are on the cars as well as the body cams. We've seen videos of police being egregiously inappropriate and not being charged. And so there's a disconnect between what we say we want, which is police accountability, and the tools we use to get there.
And this is what the state legislature has to look at, is this difference between the community values and the current law.
Yes.
And if the current law and policy of police bureaus doesn't meet community values, then we have this, we are engendering mistrust between individuals. And my fear is that when my son is 18, and if someone like my son encounters the police, and the police officer is doing a safe arrest, and my son or someone like my son doesn't trust the police, and they decide to do something really dumb, like run, then the scene gets out of control, and that's when people get hurt. So trust is almost the most important tool a police officer has. If that is abrogated, if that is usurped by the legislators not doing their jobs or the attorney general not doing her job, then we are causing the problem.
Absolutely true. We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Dave. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO. This is a morning of Dave's. Welcome.
Thank you, Joanne. I'd just like to tell Jason that I admire his ability to study the conditions and then be able to articulate evidence-based arguments that really should carry some kind of sway in reasoning that's likely to lead to changes. And I admire that and feel it's patriotic. And a quick observation on the James Chassie and Keaton Otis cases is that I believe the attorneys for the heirs of James Chassie enhanced the jailhouse audio, which enabled them to make their case in civil court.
That's correct.
And the DA in the Keaton Otis case, instead of enhancing the audio of the video of the killing, asked the videographer to leave the room as it was presented to the grand jury. So the people really don't even know whether they heard that soundtrack. And so
that's right.
On one case, you have civil courts, which are being successful, and in the other case, you have the district attorneys who may be conspiring not to indict their coworkers. But the real point that I wanted to ask some information on is about this Department of Justice settlement. And I admire your dogged determination of staying in the game there. And I was wondering if you see it as a federal intervention that leads to the expansion of police power, and in particular about the predictive qualities that the DOJ is imposing on people perceived to be in mental health crisis. I've heard the term thought policing. Is that by this settlement agreement, they're going to need to go out and proactively identify folks that they feel they're going to be likely to engage in the future. Is that correct?
Well, I think that that's a little bit of an expansion on the settlement items. I think that there are certainly the police officers who hurt James Chassie testify that they did not recognize him as a person with a mental illness, and he quite clearly had been a person with a mental illness for decades. And if they weren't capable of doing that, they really shouldn't be downtown.
Right.
So there's positive parts of training officers to do this, and unfortunately, people with mental illness suffer from the fact that the mental health system has abandoned them. The state and the county do a terrible, terrible job at providing mental health services. And we rely on police officers to help us, and we can't just ignore that. So we would like them to the police bureau to find compassionate people and to train them and to supervise them and to allow them to help us. So I think that's important. The piece about the settlement agreement that's so disappointing is not the mental health parts, which were disappointing. They were just silly, most of them. But the part that was really disappointing was the fact that the district attorney is not part of the settlement,
right,
that he's not included in any way,
right,
as a party to the settlement. There's no part for him in the DOJ. He doesn't attend the meetings.
Right.
He's not included in the settlement agreement. He's not included in the findings letter.
Right. And doesn't see that there's any problem with him prosecuting police officers if need be. I mean, you and I had that conversation with him, and he's like, oh, we don't need an independent prosecutor. No, we are very impartial. We're fair. Yet, as you said, too, in the history of the police department, it seems unusual.
Yes, Joanne, you and I have met with District Attorney Underhill, and he strikes me as a man of great integrity and a man of intelligence and certainly very capable in doing his job. But he articulated for us that there was no conflict of interest with the district attorney
and the police, right,
and the police, and because he's the elected person to do that work, we as a community decided he was the right person, and he's funded and trained and has staff and is legally the right person to do this. The dilemma is that he doesn't.
Right, right. And, you know, he and I also serve on the board of the Avell Gordley Center for Mental Health. And so I spend some time with him on a regular basis, and I agree. I think he's a nice person, but, you know, we've had nice people before in these positions with no fundamental change. And so Jason's much calmer than I am about it. As I always am, I'm like, we got to fix it now, today. So thank you, Dave. Anything else?
My final question is, now with the federal oversight going on through the settlement agreement, what impact do you think that would have on local aspirations to improve police accountability structures. Are we going to be sort of cordoned off now that all effort will go into meeting these what you call silly provisions in the settlement agreement and will stymie what's happening across the nation as other communities get together and try to seek independent civilian-based police authority?
I'll try that one. I think one of the things that happened with the agreement to the settlement is that that ceased all indigenous efforts for police reform. And now for the next 5 years or so, we're going to be wrapped up in these 180-some items, some of which are useful and some of which are just not useful. And whenever someone comes up with a new idea or a new event occurs, the mayor can simply point to the DOJ settlement process and say, get in line.
We got a plan for that. Right, right. Well, and I would add to that, I actually think it is incumbent upon us, the community advocates who have been working for reform, to continue to bring this this issue in front of the city council. Because remember, the entire city council signed off on the city council agreement. The entire city council is responsible for the millions of dollars that we're investing in Portland Police Bureau. And the entire city council has a responsibility to the public to get it right. And as you know, the settlement agreement does not address race except for the collection of data that still Portland police are not collecting, right? They really do not want to tell us how egregiously bad their stop data is, right? The last chief tried to create a minority category so you could just collapse all people of color so you wouldn't know that African Americans are four times as likely to be stopped, right? That was his fix. And so I think that the advocates have to continue to say racial profiling didn't go away. There's a plan that the settlement agreement does say that the community police over the CPRC, the Community Police Relations Committee, is supposed to implement the plan to address racial profiling, and they haven't even mentioned it yet.
I think I have to add that to my list of regulators.
Yes, because that right. So clearly. Clearly, the city council will say, we fixed the police. Give it 5 years. We got 5 years, so you know you got to give it time to be fixed. But we can't afford to wait 5 years to see that they haven't fixed what's broken.
Yeah, that strategy has been used by City Hall to fix homelessness recently. The 10-year plan that failed utterly and has now been renewed for another 10-year plan by the same people.
And did they not reduce the number now? Did they reduce the number of housing units that would be?
Yeah, I can't stop. I can't.
You don't want to go there.
No,
we're not going to go there. That's another show. Thank you for your call, Dave.
Carry on, Mr. Renaud.
Have a great day. We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Roy. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh.
Hey, Joanne. How are you?
Thank you for asking, but I can't answer. It's too much energy. But I wanted to, boy, that was a shock. but anyway, hello to everybody.
Hey.
And I just want to say a couple of things that have probably no value for anyone else but me. And I'll say first, thank you for people listening. First, one thing that makes me feel good, well, I hear you say words or phrases like pretend solutions and about nice people, because that's what I've been realizing about a lot of nice people.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the other thing was somebody was saying something about military-industrial complex, and here's what made me think about, at least right now, that this is modernized Nazism energy from World War II. And I know, that's what I forgot to say.
We love you.
This is happening across, this is probably what's happening across the country with the police department, what I just said.
Yes.
And with everything else, though, that's going on in the country. And I'll say goodbye and I'll say thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you, Joanne. Bye. We love you. Joanne had a mouthful there. Excuse me. I think we are going to just head back to the phone. Hello, Catherine. Welcome to KBOO.
Oh, hi, Joanne.
Hi.
I wanted to ask your guest if he would have any suggestions for those of us in Washington County that have experienced with our loved ones similar incidents, maybe not the execution of our loved ones, but the rapid criminalization by the powers in Washington County of people who are severely mentally ill, and where one would start to change things here.
Absolutely. There's an organization in Washington, actually it's a national organization, called the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And they are very active in Washington County, and you should call them.
Well, I have, Jason, I have done this. I've been working on this now for over a year, and they're good with helping people, you know, support kinds of issues, but seeing the big picture of what's going on in the criminal justice system in our county, I don't think people there get it.
No, that's
I think you're absolutely right. Are you familiar with an organization called Partnership for Safety and Justice?
I know about it. I haven't actually reached out to anyone there.
It's a great organization that actually works on just the issues you're talking about. They work primarily with the legislative body trying to change laws around reforming our criminal justice system. If you put the name Partnership for Safety and Justice in your search engine, it'll pop up.
Yeah, you want to talk to they have a new executive director, Andy Cole, who's really active and really interested in engaging the community. And call Andy at Partnership for Safety and Justice and roll it out for him.
Okay.
There's a lot of work to be done in Washington County. That jail is particularly dangerous to our folks.
And I understand that when people get out, there's nowhere. There's no transition housing anywhere in Washington County.
Yeah, and that's really
and
true.
And people can be let out in the middle of the night without shoes, without money. It's a terrible system.
That's criminal. And so I hope that somebody in Washington County, I don't know if you have like a cop watch kind of organization, but man, it would be really cool if somebody was taking pictures of people being released from jail in that kind of condition and then finding a lawyer to file a class action lawsuit. Because if that's not cruel and unusual punishment, I don't know what is.
It's certainly cruel and unusual. That is absolutely true.
So let me also recommend, I am the president of the Portland chapter of the NAACP, and we have a legal redress committee where we have some lawyers that help people try to figure out how to connect through the maze that you're headed through. And so if you would like to be connected to them, leave your information with my engineer, and I'll contact you after the show.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you, Joanne.
You're welcome. And by the way, become an NAACP member. We're looking for members.
Okay.
And you can come and help us build it up. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Have a great day. 503-231-8187. Looks like we got about 6 minutes left. Hello, Francis. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi.
Hey, Francis.
Happy to hear about the NAACP. That's very good news. And the legal redress is functioning?
Well, it's functioning good at the moment. It could always be better, but it is definitely functioning, yes.
One thing I wanted to say, and I can remember when Tony Stevenson was choked to death and the police officers, some of them had made T-shirts that said, "Don't choke them, smoke them."
Yep.
And since then, that's what they've been doing is shooting people. And I'd like to propose that, to me, this whole notion of they don't know how to treat people with mental illness, and the fact that they did this totally, not even discuss racial profiling, but even though they do speak about treating how they treat people with mental illness, I would like to propose that it really didn't matter whether they knew that Mr. Chassie was mentally ill or not. What they did was wrong.
Right.
Whatever his mental state was.
There's no
and
disagreement
for them to
there.
Be able to say that, well, this just happened because they didn't understand that he was mentally ill.
Right.
That's wrong. They committed a brutal act on a man, whether he was mental ill or not. What happened to Freddie Gray was brutally wrong. And now those officers who were charged with that the police department in Baltimore is suggesting that they're not working because no one has their back, because the state's attorney doesn't have their back. For them to be able to respond in that manner is wrong. And for the police officers in Portland to respond in that manner, well, we're just not going to do our job, because you're going to arrest us if we do it. They're suggesting that violating people's rights and killing them is somehow part of their job, and we're not letting them do that.
It's crazy. It only works if you're a police officer. It's police officer logic, right? We did nothing wrong.
But people buy that. Our community buys that.
Well, we have to stop buying that. Thank you so much for your call. I appreciate you calling. I appreciate you. You're one of those that have been around for quite a while doing police accountability. So I appreciate you. Thank you so much. Have a great day. 503-231-8187 is the number. We just have a few minutes left. I do want to circle back around to some conclusions and leave people with some hope, because I don't know, maybe you and I are flawed individuals, Jason, because you and I still have hope. I mean, we still believe, we're still optimistic, we still believe that community engagement, community involvement will make a difference in fixing what's wrong in our community. And so what would you recommend? What would you suggest people do? You did recommend the AMA, and it's the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. Look for us on Facebook, and their meetings have been weird lately. It used to be the first Thursday of the month, but now that this COAB, the Community Oversight Advisory Board, seems to have taken up most Thursdays, I think that we're going to reset the general meeting date. But you can go to Facebook or the website for updates on that information. Also, the NAACP Portland chapter general meeting, the fourth Saturday of the month, 12 noon to 2 at the Portland Red Cross.
I think it's easy to be cynical, and it's easy to be angry, and it's easy to run in the streets when something happens. And I think this actually is doesn't help the problem. I think that this actually gets the mainstream individuals who have the time and treasure and talent and tools to help to stay home. But we do need young people who need to who want to get involved to come to these organizations and these meetings and get a little experience of this this hope and this this optimism that we have about fixing things. I mean, if we were in St. Louis, if I wouldn't be doing this, I'd be doing something else, because I wouldn't believe that St. Louis could change. I've been to St. Louis. I've seen the police in action, and it's not in my lifetime. There's no amount of effort that I could put in that would make things better.
Well, it's ironic you say that. I'm from Baltimore, so I kind of feel the same way about Baltimore Police Bureau. You know, if I was in Baltimore, I would not be doing police accountability work.
But this must drive you to do work here because you believe things can be better.
Yes.
You know, I mean, this is our job, is to keep hope alive. You know, that's the real mission of advocates, is to not let people despair and say, no, that's just, I'm going to sit in my garden and have some iced tea and watch Netflix and tune out.
Right.
No, come on down to the meeting.
It's too big. We can't do anything. That's not the answer for what's wrong. I really appreciate you saying that. And you're right. I mean, it's exactly what we need, is more people. But, you know, I have hope because I spend a lot of time on college campuses. And these young people are fired up.
Yeah.
They understand inequity. They understand police brutality, and they want to fix it. And I love the creativity by which they are starting to take action. So I'm feeling better. I'm feeling old, but I'm feeling better that there are folks coming behind us that are going to make this happen. It is always a pleasure to talk to you, Jason. You do such wonderful work in our community. I want to thank you publicly for just, I mean, I've known you for a bazillion years, and you've always consistently been a compassionate advocate for our community. And so I thank you for all you do. This has been another How Quickly the Hour Goes When You're Having Fun. This has been another great Voices from the Edge. Next week, I'm going to be talking to some board members from the Avell Gordley Center for Mental Health about the incident that happened on Alberta for last Thursday a few weeks ago in a community response that we're developing. And so I will leave you intrigued there. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you, Steve. I have the best engineer. Have a great day. See you next week, same time, same place, same station.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's not all that glitter is gold. After story had never been told, so now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
And good morning. You are listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Never giving up the fight on your Thursday morning with lots to do today, or lots to hear anyway. We've got Air Cascadia coming your way at 10 o'clock this morning with host Chris Andre presenting headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. Today, we'll hear the latest news about Texas and their most restrictive abortion legislation to date, HB2. We'll talk about recent revelations by Caitlyn Jenner, and we'll hear part 13 of our series, The Battle for Public Education. At 11, we'll hear Between the Covers with host Lisa Loving. Today's guest is Stacey Wakefield, author of the new novel, The Sunshine Crust Baking Factory. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures with host S.W. Conser. Today's guest is local artist Philip Barash, who exhibits his large-scale oil paintings at Portland Area Galleries and Industrial Spaces, then adapts the panels into card sets and sequential narratives. That is all coming up this morning. Up next, it's an hour-long edition of Press Watch with host Teresa Mitchell. Stick around for all the news you're not supposed to know. It's KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is accepting toys for